David and I sold Causal to Grafana Labs. Grafana Labs was 25 people at the time. Sometimes you need that like bloody-minded perseverance, and like sometimes you need the sunk cost fallacy. Like there's an interesting topic where I think the reason Loki was successful from an engineering perspective was because I did a bad job of implementation. The other big lesson was...
Welcome, everyone. Today we are excited to host Tom Wilkie on our podcast. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad.
Amazing. So Tom is really smart engineer, at least from my perspective. I actually saw you, Tom, coding this year, despite being CTO of Grafana Labs, which is like startup with like more than 1,000 employees, I think. That's what the internet says. Is it true?
It's true that we have more than 1,000 employees. Yeah, and I'm not sure it's true I was coding, though. Do you remember what I was working on?
Maybe would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I'm Tom. I'm the CTO of Grafana Labs. I live in London. Been in the tech space for 15 plus years now. My background's mostly doing tech startups, really. Like I started my first company when I was like 23 or 24, working on the Cassandra distributed database. I did a brief stint at Google. Used to work for Weaveworks. I did another startup of my own, and then that joined Grafana Labs, and that joined Grafana Labs 6.5 years ago now, I think. So been here for a while, joined, mostly really as an individual contributor, back when the company was 25 people. Engineer, been doing software for a very long time. I'm on the Prometheus team with Bartek, so I've contributed, I don't think there's any of my code left in Prometheus now, but like a while ago, I contributed
there
to
is.
Prometheus.
There I is. Should... I was fixing it.
Well, yeah, that's definitely a common pattern.
Yeah, thank you. Now, lots of amazing parts we could dive into, but I just want to put it out loud. Like, I'm really grateful, Tom, that you are here and I kind of met you at some point. I learned so much from you. And you probably noticed that you were kind of my implicit mentor from the days I was starting, contributing to Prometheus and Cortex and Thanos projects. Thank you for that. And I actually Googled that, implicit mentor. That's a word.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. I'm flattered. I remember the first time I met you, Bartek, in the pub in Shoreditch. You were working for Improbable at the time.
Yeah, look at this.
Oh, you've got the Improbable hoodie on.
Still, but cool. I remember you first more on in Weaveworks office when we discussed the big table, I think, integration.
So for the listeners, right, Cortex was a horizontally scalable version of Prometheus. It was one of the first, like, I'm not sure it was necessarily the first, because I remember there was a chap at DigitalOcean working on a scalable version of Prometheus around the same time as me.
Yeah,
I've forgotten his name now.
I think it's the first popular in the CNCF, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I started the project when I was at Weaveworks, and it originally used Cassandra to store all its data, right? Because my background was in Cassandra, and it was easy for me to get started that way. But operating, running Cassandra at scale can be painful, and a lot of people were looking for kind of quote unquote hosted Grafana options. So we added support for DynamoDB and for Bigtable, right? So that you could run it on Google and Amazon Cloud. When we were first, Cortex was not quite version one then. We were running it in production and playing with things like that. It was good fun.
Yeah. Lots of interesting story here. I don't know if you, maybe very quickly, of course we introduced the object storage for like combined storage for this open source, observability monitoring solution or metric solution. And then kind of like many projects followed. But recently, Cortex maintainers, current Cortex maintainers, they kind of like investigate switching back to like a separate index and chunks because there were trade-offs.
Yeah, no, 100% trade-off. I mean, Thanos, right, introduced the object storage idea first, not Cortex. Yeah, we're 100%. The Cortex team copied what you, Bartek,
and that's okay.
Thanos,
but it's funny how cycles.
100%. Like it was a lot of fun though. Like that was mostly, I can't take credit at that point. I think I was, I transitioned mostly into management. I had a team of like 30 people, I think, at that point. And it was Marco, right, who really did the heavy lifting there, who, worked on Thanos and then worked on bringing that into Cortex. But yeah, it's, I mean, the reason for the switch for us was cost, if I'm brutally honest. Like, storing the blocks in object storage is significantly more cost effective than using DynamoDB or Bigtable or Cassandra, right? And I remember we keep track of costs pretty closely in Grafana Labs, as you can imagine. Like, we sell a hosted Prometheus service, and we have to make sure that we make money doing that and don't sell it for less than we cost us to run it. I mean, fun story, right? My startup Causal after Weaveworks was actually selling Prometheus metrics at below cost. I didn't realize it at the time. I just didn't have a good handle on it. But like, the list price that we sold to our early customers, you know, we were not making a profit on. And that only really came to light a few years later when we were kind of really running the numbers. But yeah, big reason for switching to block storage was cost. It was about an eighth of the price, like TCO of running Cortex on BigQuery versus running Cortex on object storage was about an eighth. So a huge reduction and really, really moved the needle for us.
Definitely. But now I think, yeah, it takes effort to kind of like scale it in terms of latency. You have to be smart about caching, about, you know, where to put things. And now people are kind of like challenging, okay, maybe it's actually easier to pay more and have faster storage. Yeah.
I mean, there's no right or wrong answer here, right? You know, there's different trade-offs, right? We've found with the object storage side of things, generally, if you have to go to object storage to answer a user's query, you've already lost. Like, you know, you've already, it's already cost you too much to do that, right? So you want to get, and I think, I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but I think like, you know, 99% of queries up to Grafana Cloud are hitting memory, right? Are hitting the storage gateways, are hitting the memcaches, are hitting some form of cache that isn't in the object storage. And that leaves the object storage and the pool of query workers really just to process the very long or very large queries that represent like a fraction of the queries sent to the cloud.
Yeah. All right. Amazing dive into some very...
Oh, yeah, I can go really deep really quickly. Sorry about that.
That's fine. That's epic. But yeah, let's start from the start. I think the first question we'd like to ask is like, how you end up in engineering? How you end up software development?
I've got some friends, some American friends staying with me at the moment. And we were having this debate last night in the pub. Because like the American education system stays very general very late, like until your early 20s, you're still studying five or six different topics. And I'm British, right? I'm English. So we, you know, our education system is the exact opposite. Like, you specialize very quickly, right? So, you know, at age 14, you pick like eight topics you want to do. And then at age 18, you pick like effectively three or four topics you want to do. And then at age, you know, university at age 18, you pick one topic you want to do, and you specialize very early. And so it was super lucky for me that I knew from probably like when I was 12 or 13, I think, when my mum got a grant from the government to buy a computer for her degree, that I wanted to work with computers. Like, I remember, you know, I can picture it now. I know exactly what the spec of the first computer we had in the house was. And my mum was studying at the Open University for a maths degree because the government had said all teachers must have degrees. My mum was a teacher and didn't have a degree. So she got funding to do a degree while she was doing her job. And the computer was a Pentium 75. It had 8 megabytes of RAM and a 1 gigabyte hard disk. Like, I remember it vividly, running Windows 95. And I started reading and learning about it. And I somehow got my hands on a copy of Visual Basic. And so started using Basic. And just, you know, constantly broke this computer that my mum needed for her degree. Like, it wouldn't boot. Like, I was reinstalling from the wheel. It had a CD drive. So I was reinstalling Windows 95 from the CD, you know, probably once a month because I'd completely balked the whole system. And that's how I really learned to at least use a computer. And then my parents basically said, Tom, you got to stop breaking this computer. And so my dad had a ZX Spectrum kit that he got, I don't know, in the 80s, I assume, right? And that he'd never done anything with. So we, you know, dad and I got the kit out, we soldered it all together, we put it all together, and I started learning, you know, how to program on the ZX Spectrum in BASIC. And I remember there was something wrong, like I'd done a shoddy job of soldering it together, because like a program too big would just crash, right? And I think there was like a memory like line for the address bus or something, I don't know, like I'm not a hardware guy, that I just like soldered poorly and like so... But, you know, it was a lot of fun, like, you know, and that cut my teeth on programming until I was like better, good enough now that I went back to the P75 and started, I think I got my hands on a copy of Delphi, at Ball and Delphi. And that's when, like, things, you know, I'd never liked BASIC. So, but knowing Pascal, you know, starting to learn Pascal and starting to build little Windows apps, and then C++ Builder came out and I learned C++. And I remember my first project in C++ Builder was like a multi-threaded web server. I didn't know anything about locking or threading at that point, right? So it worked. I mean, I was literally like, you know, just cutting up strings and writing them, but it worked, except for it would crash quite frequently. And yeah, that was, you know, that takes me up to, I don't know, like maybe 13, 14. Until then, like, I started getting serious about it, started reading about it, started actually learning. My parents bought me a modem so I could have like dial-up 14.4 internet access. And the minute you're on the internet, you can self-teach everything, right? So just started learning and discovering and reading and building applications. And you get, you know, obviously in the teens, you get into building websites because you can get paid to do that, you know. So, you know, you used to get like 50 quid to build a, you know, in Notepad, build a website at HTML and CSS, well, crappy CSS. And yeah, you know, it took off from there. And I remember I was really lucky because my school didn't have like any computer science or IT on the curriculum at all. Like, but they had a computer room. And so I could spend some time in there and learn from other people. And I think the teachers, you know, it was a good school. It was a state school, but it was a really good school. And they, the teacher kind of, one of my teachers, the biology teacher, I remember, recognized that, you know, there's something going on here. And he took me to Oxford University on an open day when I must have been 16, maybe 17. No, I think it was 16. And he arranged for me, I assume he had actually been to this college for his undergrad education. I don't know that for a fact, but like, and he arranged for me to spend an hour with the computer science fellow at this college, who basically just gave me a pile of books and told me, look, if you actually want to learn about computer science and how to do this. And one of the first books was on Haskell. I've still got it somewhere. And that got me into like more like treating it seriously and not just like learning ad hoc. The other book that I really got into, because I was always fascinated with like, I knew the Pentium processor that I had a single core and could do one thing at once. Yet I knew I had multiple windows on my screen doing multiple things at the same time. So I was always fascinated by like the how do we do multitasking on a computer? And so I remember like a formative book for me was the Tannenbaum book about OS design. I can't remember what it's called, but the one that Linus Torvalds read, and you know, the one that became Minix, and then obviously he started Linux. And there, it was just from there, like I just self-taught and learned. And then, you know, I got good grades at school and went and studied computer science at university. And that's really where it took off, right? Because at that point, I was a Windows and Mac guy, right? Like I didn't really live in the terminal until I got to university. And there's all these people, you know, just have text on their screens, right? And not like, you know, not like UIs. And I'm like, oh, how does this work? And then I realized I was actually like behind the curve in a lot of ways, because like, you know, the people I was sitting next to my age, you know, had already like coded on the kernel and were just, you know, in Vi and learned how, you know, tool chains work and things like that. And so bit of a baptism of fire. I distinctly remember learning about tab completion in the terminal. I remember the chap who taught me, it was one of the lecturers at college. And he how do you not know this? He was like, you know, teasing me almost about it. And it just, you know, and it was just transformative. And I was super lucky from university because the college I went to, the director of studies, like the professor who was in charge of my studies, was the chap who started the Zen Hypervisor, right? So a chap called Ian Pratt. And he was very kind to me and like, you know, gave me loads of opportunities to get involved in a popular open source project. I mean, I didn't even know really what open source was at the time, right? But he got me a chance to like work on Zen. I was working in Python on the tools for Zen, on like the Zendy, it was called, like the daemon that was running that managed the VMs. And then after I graduated, I got a chance to join his startup to work on that Zen source. And that was, you know, so, wow, first job out of university was a startup. It was a tech startup that, you know, sold for some ridiculous sum of money to Cisco. I mean, I didn't make any money out of it, but like, you know, seeing that, that was how, you know, the tech startup industry worked and how open source worked, and such a baptism of fire and such a great opportunity to have. It was natural that I was always going to be in open source. I was always going to do my own startups, and the die was really cast from then.
And tell us a little bit about your first startup. Now, you told us the origin story. We know why you would want to start a company, but like, how did you come up with the idea? What was your first startup doing?
There's no good answer to that, really. We picked the people we wanted to work with.
Yep.
My co-founders, Tim and Andy, like, we decided between the three of us that we wanted to do something together. We had no idea what we wanted to do. And so whilst we were working, we would spend weekends, evenings together, just hashing out various ideas. And it took us a very long time. I remember, like, I installed a whiteboard in my front room in my house I'm not at college anymore, but the house in Cambridge. And just tried different things. So the original idea for the startup was called Acunu, ACUNU, which means something rude in French that we discovered a few years later. The original idea was actually it was storage for virtual machines, was the idea. Cause my background was in virtual machines, and the challenge at ZenSource was always storage, right? We could virtualize memory and CPU and network and all of these really great things, but it relied on you having a relatively expensive kind of SAN or NAS attached to your cluster. And so the original idea was to build a commodity kind of clustered VM storage device. And that lasted for a couple of years, that idea, we should have lasted for 6 months or 3 months, as we realized it was a terrible idea because you're ending up competing with like NetApp and EMC, and very, very hard to compete with them as an underfunded British tech startup. It took us 2 years to really figure out that was not going to be a good idea. And we'd raised, we had a bit of experience we got a bit of experience through that process of raising a little bit of venture capital from some English VC firms, British VC firms. And it was then we pivoted, we took all the technology that we'd built. So we ended up building this kernel module we called it a file system, but it wasn't for files, it was for blocks. We ended up building this kernel module called Castle, named after the Castle pub in Cambridge. And it used all sorts of really funky algorithms, like, because Andy was, I think he was lecturing at Oxford University at this point. And like, there was loads of really like cutting edge. So we would call them log structured merge trees now. But back then that term didn't exist, right? Back then we would call them, I think we called them doubling arrays. And all these cache oblivious algorithms, and did all sorts of fancy things. We actually published a paper based on like this versioning of a log structured merge tree, because we wanted to be able to do like snapshots and versions and, have it all really low overhead and everything. So that became, we built this kernel module, and then obviously, no one wants to buy virtual machine storage from a 10 person company. And so we pivoted, NoSQL became a thing that was happening. It was a trend, and big data and Hadoop and everything was starting to be a trend. So we were like, oh, let's take our technology. We had what was effectively a good indexing data structure written in C in the kernel that was very high performance. Let's see if we can apply that to another database. So we actually initially applied it to all of the databases, right? So we went and wrote a backend for Mongo. We wrote a backend for MySQL. We wrote a backend for Cassandra. We wrote a backend for Voldemort. Who remembers Voldemort? Like LinkedIn's key value store, right? I mean, there was one for Memcache. The list was endless of these backends that we wrote. But the one that kind of, I think, caught people's imagination was the Cassandra one, because Cassandra, of all that list, was seeming to be taking off the most, which in hindsight, right, is funny, because obviously Mongo took off the most. But Cassandra seemed to be taking off the most. We landed like a handful of early customers on our enterprise version of Cassandra, which was Cassandra plus some management tools plus the storage engine. And of course, at the end of the day, the thing that was valuable in that company wasn't the storage engine. That got thrown away. It wasn't even the management tools. That also got thrown away. It was this demo. Effectively, it was a demo that we built on top of Cassandra, right? Because one of the things that we learned in the Acunu days, other than we move too slowly and like don't raise VC before you have like, an actual product, or at least like a decent idea and a bit of product market fit. The other big lesson was, we were like a 20, 30 person company, sitting in London, just north of Shoreditch, just north of Silicon Roundabout, and loving the life. Like, it was brilliant. It was loads of fun. But we didn't need, as a team, like our own Cassandra for anything. We had no big data. We had no need for this, right? And so we were like, we weren't dog fooding our own product, right? And therefore, like, understanding why customers did or didn't want certain things was kind of a really slow and painful process. Like, you had to talk to them, you know, and they wouldn't, you know, they don't necessarily tell you exactly what they think. You know, they tell you what they, you know, they want a faster horse, not a car type thing. So we looked for opportunities to dog food our product, and we ended up, we did a lot of QA, right? Because we're building a storage system. So a huge QA effort went involved. And we ended up storing the results of the QA system in Cassandra, because that was the closest thing we had to big data. I mean, it could have fit in a MySQL database, but still. And we built an analysis system on our QA data that effectively kept a load, like a materialized view of a load of aggregates. Like, it was, Cassandra had this kind of incremental counter thing going on. And this QA system prototype demo-y stuff that we'd built, that got turned into a product that we called Kuno Analytics. It was like a real-time analytics thing that we plugged on top of Cassandra that would, you know, you give it SQL queries and it would maintain like a materialized view of counters to allow you to answer those queries very, very quickly. And that was the thing that got people interested, you know, and in particular got Apple interested. And so, you know, I think by that point, the challenge was we'd raised too much money, you know, we were too diluted, you know, we'd pivoted too many times too slowly. And for me, at least personally, like, the spark had gone. And so I left the company for a job offer at Google. You know, the company subsequently got sold. And, you know, which was nice, like, still got a little bit of money out of it, but I don't view it as a huge success. But a huge learning opportunity is the main thing I took away from Kuno. Like, we made a lot of mistakes. Like, the hard way we learned, like, don't build a product you don't need. Don't, you know, don't raise too much money too quickly. Don't get diluted. Don't, you know, also silly things like, you know, we had a very, you know, there's only 30 of us and we had like three layers of management. Like, everyone, you know, in 30 people, everyone should just report to the CEO. Like, you don't need these overheads. And, you know, the culture, we were in an in-office culture. So we had like, everyone had to come into the office every day. Like, you know, I think the younger version of myself didn't really trust people. And like, all of these horrible mistakes we made, right? And so it took me a good 4 or 5 or 6 years to have the energy and probably the maturity and the self-reflection to actually admit like all of those mistakes and to have another go at it with Causal and Grafana Labs. But yeah, I also, like, one of the things that happens as a startup founder is you're forced to become a manager, right? Like, you know, someone's got to manage these people and you can't really delegate that away. So I became a manager at whatever, like 24, which is a terrible idea. At the time I just thought, well, I'll wing it, you know, whatever, it'll be fine. And then when I went and worked for Google, I was a site reliability manager for the Google Analytics team. And Google has incredible internal training. They call it GLearn. Right. So I got on these residential courses on management and so on. And I love learning. Right. So I'm like, yeah, sign me up for absolutely everything. I remember one of my favorite courses was the barista training course. I just made myself a flat white with latte art this morning because I still love that kind of thing. But yeah, the management training at Google, you know, opened my eyes to how terrible a manager I was. Like, and I'm like, oh man, like, I've made every mistake that this course is listing. And in general, like, you know, the startup had sold. I didn't enjoy my time as a middle manager at Google very much, to be honest. Like, Google's a fantastic company and I would 100% go back and be an IC there. I think it's a brilliant place to work, but I was not enjoying the role as a site reliability manager. I'm not an ops person. And so I left Google and took a year out, learned to brew beer and got into 3D printing and, you know, got into, you know, everything, you name it. And it was then that I was ready, you know, okay, I've learned, I know what I want to do. I knew I didn't want to be a manager. I knew I wanted to be a software engineer. I knew I wanted to build tools for other software engineers. I wanted to dog food them. I wanted to work on open source. I like working for startups. Like, I then, you know, developed a set of pretty strong opinions about what I wanted to do with the rest of my career and life, which was fun.
Nice, nice. Let's pause a bit because it's already a lot of probably questions to ask here. I mean, such an amazing story. And I mean, sounds like it's also learning opportunities to learn all those databases on the way, right? Because you had to integrate with them.
I mean, the hilarious thing was, I didn't want to be, you know, university, if you ask the like 18, 19 year old version of me, I did not want to be a distributed systems person. Like, I didn't really care for networks and that kind of thing. I didn't want to be a database person, right? Like, Cambridge University had a really good distributed systems and database team, and I wasn't in it, right? And I didn't want to be in it. I was in the OS side of things, like the virtualization and kernels and this kind of stuff. And that's what I thought I wanted to do. But actually, like, on reflection, you know, all the hard problems with operating systems have been solved, I think, you know, pretty much, you know, and all the virtualization stuff we were doing had been invented by IBM in the 50s anyway. Like, so actually the more interesting stuff was happening in the databases and distributed systems side of things. And I very quickly through Okunu and obviously then Google runs huge distributed systems, very quickly learned that's where the exciting and challenging problems are. Like, and that's where I got, you know, interested. Like, and honestly, like, I still firmly believe that as an engineer, a large part of your motivation is just interest. Like, you know, it's not money, it's not power. It's just like, is this an exciting and interesting problem for me to solve, right?
And exactly, I wanted to ask about this. Like, your story, especially from the technical perspective, it sounds like a dream for software engineer. Like, oh my God, I touched this backend, this, you know, scalable algorithms and data structures. And I wonder, in those 3 years, like, that was your life in a sense of like, that was your day-to-day basis. You were coding, you were kind of researching, you were running, you were scaling, testing, or how much you were actually focused on the things that, you know, entrepreneurs kind of talk about daily. Is like, oh, leads, I will to conference and I can try to, you know, like talk to somebody who could, you know, I could sell to. Like, how much, like, did you manage to kind of offload that to some other people, or you were actually doing this, but do you like it?
Do you mean now in my role in Grafana Labs?
No. I would say in the past, yeah.
Yeah, so I used to be, you know, at Okunu and at Google. So at Okunu, I was like, I that was not my problem, right? Not my job. And that's a terrible attitude to have, right? You 100% should not have that attitude. And that was one of the reasons I don't think the company was as successful as it could have been. But the Google, I was a manager, right? Like, I had performance reviews and all that stuff to do. And I didn't really get to do any interesting technical. Like, I was in the room when a lot of very interesting technical stuff happened and was envious, to be brutally honest, of the engineers that got to do it, right? Like, that's why after Google, I went back to being an IC, because I realized that was the thing I really, you know, enjoyed. Like, and at Google, you know, in the SRE role, like, I was so abstracted away from customers and the business side of things. I also realized I missed that from Okunu days, right? You know, I do want to know how the sausage is made, right? And I, you know, it is exciting to actually have your software meet real use cases and all of your great, you know, vision and idea and designs all completely crumble when that happens and the customer wants something completely different, right? Like, so I wanted, you know, I was excited when I joined Weaveworks because that seemed like the perfect role. Like, small startup, I think I was like number 7 at Weaveworks. And I joined the same day or like a week after Brian Borum, right? Who the other Prometheus maintainer, which is when I met him. And I was working on WeaveNet, right? So WeaveNet at the time was brilliant, right? This was pre-Kubernetes. Docker was, you know, pretty young, but had already like completely taken over the world in terms of like, at least like, you know, blanking for words, sorry. Yeah, the Docker had completely taken over the world at least, but Docker didn't have a network, right? So Docker worked great on a single machine, but between multiple machines, it just didn't do anything, right? And that was what WeaveNet, and then WeaveNet was basically being used with a very, very large proportion of everyone using Docker. So I'm like, popular open source project, interesting technology in a space that like I literally use on a day-to-day basis. Like, I had Docker running on my laptop before I joined Weaveworks. You know, and generally, yeah, like, I'm like, this fits, you know, it's aimed at software engineers, it's open source, it's a tech startup. Like, I'm going to go in as an engineer and have real impact, like actually get to work on the exciting and interesting problems. And I was like, this is brilliant. You know, we should, you know, and they had good, you know, they had good founders, had good funding as well from Excel. So I was like, this dream come true. It's the perfect job. And for the first year or so, it was like, I got to work on the IP address management system with Brian in Weave, which was like a core distributed system, like was a lot of fun to work on and solved some really hard problems. And then I got to work on the DNS system in Weave. Like, I threw the old one away and completely rewrote it. And again, a lot of fun. Like, it worked incredibly. You know, I was really proud of that. And I think that's still probably one of my the best bits of code I've ever written. But then Docker bought Socketplane, I think they were called, which was another competing Docker network. And almost overnight, I mean, in hindsight, overnight, you know, we've stopped being a popular open source project and stopped being the future. Docker just bundled their own network. And, you know, Weaveworks, we had to find something else to do, right? Because doing a Docker network was never going to be a viable business then, which was a real shame. Like, you know, that's when I started looking into observability, like, and, you know, still wanted to do developer tools. I worked briefly on a thing called Weavescope, which was this kind of visualization, like it would, you know, monitor all the network connections and then visualize the architecture of your application. It demoed very well, like, and was used a lot in presentations and at booths at KubeCon, but it would never particularly useful, in my opinion, to be brutally honest. But as part of putting Weavescope, we built a SaaS version of Weavescope, so a big scalable multi-tenant version of Weavescope, which was, you know, I remember it being like a three-month project, and it was fantastic because I basically, you know, took every component of Weavescope, broke this monolith down into microservices, and then scaled them all in different ways. You know, that was a lot of fun with a tiny little team. Like, we just did it all. We ran it on Kubernetes. We monitored it with Prometheus, right? And instrumented Weavescope with Prometheus because obviously ex-Google also is looking for, you know, Kubernetes is the Borg, what Prometheus is the Borgmon.
Similarities, yeah.
Yeah, and that was when I got introduced to Prometheus, right? This was I don't think Prometheus had Kubernetes service discovery at this point. Like, I think the Prometheus data source in Grafana had only just been added, right? Like, and so it was like pretty cutting edge. And I was like, oh, this Prometheus thing, Scope's not useful, but this Prometheus thing is useful. Like, this got me insight into the behavior of my application beyond any other tool I could. And the language was not, you know, Borgmon's language, obviously very similar to Prometheus, but has a lot of warts on it and a lot of legacy. Prometheus was just, to me, a better, cleaner, simpler version of Borgmon. Like, you know, and it just really clicked all of a sudden. And I'm like, okay, when you know, I worked on Scope for 6 months. And, well, maybe more than that, actually, it might have been a year, and just decided, yeah, this is not for me. And so I was like, I went to the founders and said, I want to build a scalable version of this Prometheus thing. And that's when I met Julius. So Julius came and consulted for Weaveworks as well, and he and I started Cortex together. I think Julius worked on it for 6 months, a year. But yeah, and then Cortex, I think, I remember going to the first Prometheus Dev Summit where I kind of gave a talk on Cortex, and then Bjorn invited me to join the Prometheus team, and I did the Prometheus Rewrite work, and it all kind of snowballed from there, right? Didn't, you know, at that point, I don't think, you know, in my own opinion, right, I don't think Weaveworks really ever recovered from Socketplane being bought by Docker. They went on to do that Flux work, which seemed to capture people's imagination more. But yeah, like for me, Weaveworks was done. So I left, and I wanted to repeat what I'd done with Cortex, like build a scalable version of Prometheus. I wanted to do that for logging. So I'd used Elastic in the past for logging, and thought it was fantastic. Really enjoyed. Well, sorry, I thought like the idea of logs and metrics was fantastic, and you know, we arranged to have the same labels in our Prometheus that we had in our Elastic, but Elastic was a pain, and I really don't like the JVM. I'm allowed to have opinions, right? And so I wanted, and I was, you know, really enjoying working in Go. And I really enjoyed it, you know, Kubernetes and Prometheus and Go and all of this like ecosystem we were in. And so I thought, let's build a Prometheus inspired log aggregation system in Go, right? And I mean, at the time it wasn't called Loki. At the time, oh, I can't even remember what it was called. Was it called Tempo? Was it called, I forget, it was called something else. But yeah, started a project and a company around Loki, and was having a lot of fun doing that with David. You know, we launched the company Causal at PromCon. You probably remember that, Bartek, right? We launched at PromCon in Munich. But everyone I spoke to just wanted this Prometheus thing, which was hilarious, right? I was trying to sell a prototype for Prometheus-inspired logs, and they were like, yeah, but can you just help us with this Prometheus thing? And it was just really obvious. I think we were only running Causal for 9 months, and it was just really obvious the market was for Prometheus, like, and the customers wanted Prometheus, and I wasn't going to succeed in the Loki thing, at least in the timescales that I needed to. And so we started, you know, we started helping, you know, one or two customers with Cortex, And then, you know, eventually that got that raised the interest of Grafana Labs. And so I knew Carl, right? Carl at Grafana Labs used to turn up to the Prometheus conference. He used to turn up every year, and Grafana had this unique capability to tell the Prometheus team how popular Prometheus was, right? So he would stand up on stage and go like, last year, you know, based on Grafana's analytics, you know, embedded Google Analytics, we could see this many Prometheus data sources, like 5% of Grafana instances. This year it's 10% of Grafana instances, and Grafana was growing like crazy as well. You know, and then the year after it was 20%, and the year after it was 40%, and now it's basically 100%.
Can I ask why Carl was doing this? What was the motivation of Grafana of standing on the scene? And
yeah, it's a really good question, right? Like, Grafana takes a different approach to open source. Open source for me was always almost a means to an end up to this point, right? You know, I enjoyed working on open source. I liked being able to work on the same project, you know, in multiple companies. Like, and I liked being able to collaborate and read the source code of the things I used. But I hadn't really given enough thought to like almost the business model behind open source and what that meant for a business. But Grafana at the time, you know, had already done a lot of that thinking. Like, I can't claim any credit for this. Like, you know, they had a very popular open source project. And instead of going the traditional route of keeping like SSO and auth for the enterprise version, you know, that was all in the open source, right? And Grafana was, you know, crazy popular, like very widely used. And so they were mostly looking at like a very different model. Like, instead of like, we need to turn like half of our community into customers, Grafana Labs and the team had this philosophy of like, we need to make the Grafana community as big as possible. Like, this literally should be every software engineer in the world uses Grafana, right? And then we really only need like 1% of them to pay, right? And we'll be, you know, more, that'll be more than enough revenue to drive a very large, you know, software company. And so I think Carl's motivation was, and I don't think they were just doing this with Grafana, to be clear. I think they did this with Influx. They, you know, this is before my time. We were doing this with Graphite. We just went into every community and would talk to them and evangelize for Grafana and share this kind of information. And yeah, like, it worked, right? Like, and you know, seven years later, we're sitting here as a, you know, as a 1,200 person company. Like, so yeah, like, that I think was why Carl was doing that. But yeah, and when I met Carl, you know, got to know him, he's a very friendly chap. And every time you meet him, he gives you a big hug. And he then, I think it was the DockerCon, or was it the KubeCon in Austin that year, he introduced me to Raj, the CEO. And we hit it off, like, you know, really quickly. Like, you know, similar stories about like previous startups that were, you know, not as successful as they could have been, but learned a hell of a lot. And yeah, we ended up like, initially, like, I don't know, I can't remember the exact conversation, but initially I think it was like, you know, was Grafana Labs or was Raj going to invest in Causal? And then were we going to partner on a hosted Prometheus service? And then it's just like, look, Tom, just join Grafana Labs. And so, you know, David and I sold Causal to Grafana Labs. Grafana Labs was 25 people at the time, right? And so when I joined, like, you know, I just installed Cortex on our Kubernetes cluster. I set up our Kubernetes clusters. I installed Cortex on them. I, you know, that was when we got into JSONnet and what was a KSONnet at the time is now Tanker. Like, and, you know, the Loki prototype, you know, about 9 months, a year later, the Loki prototype got put into service and we started signing customers onto that. And well, the rest is history, really.
Was it a difficult decision to stop being a founder and join another company, kind of say, okay, I'm done with the startup, want to do it as part of Grafana?
Yeah, it was, I mean, I don't really look at it like that because Grafana Labs was so small.
Yep.
Like, it wasn't, you know, yeah, okay, I'm not a founder of Grafana Labs, 100%. But we, at Grafana Labs, we talk about these founding moments, like, and obviously the first one is when Anthony Torkel and Raj got together, you know, and when Torkel started the Grafana project. But like the second one they normally talk about is the point at which I joined the company and brought in the Prometheus expertise. And we talk about that as the start of kind of the company's act two, where we built these databases that now fuel, you know, a huge amount of our revenue. But it's not, that's not, you know, we don't stop there. We talk about when like our first, when Graham, like the first proper, in inverted commas, salesperson joined and really taught us that sales isn't just, you know, going down the bar and playing golf with customers, but there's actually like a, you know, a technique and a discipline to it, and process and things you can learn, and you can make it repeatable. And when Doug joined and kind of really up-leveled our go-to-market motion, or when Kranowitz, our CRO, joined, you know, we talk about all of these different founding moments when, you know, when the Amixer team joined and started OnCall, or when, you know, all of these different founding moments we talk about. So I don't, you know, I'm not a founder of Grafana Labs, to be very clear, but I still feel like a lot of the same emotions that I think a founder does about this team and this company and this organization. Like, and so, and yeah, so no, I don't really. Like, it's very different to, like, you know, selling a 30-person company to a, you know, million-person company. Like, that, you know, completely erases the company's identity. But I feel like, yeah, Causal as a brand doesn't exist, but who cares? Like, Causal brand was nothing. Like, but the idea and the vision and the work we were doing at Causal completely exists and, yep, like, you know, defines the second act for Grafana Labs.
Yep, yep, definitely. Makes sense. So you joined as a VP of product, or was there a title even when you were only like 25 people?
We were just in the kind of phase where we should probably put titles in place and make sure everyone knows, you know, knows what their title was. And I joined as VP product, but I had no product management expertise. Right. And the idea was, Raj wanted to kind of recognize that I wasn't just purely kind of tech and eng, but like with the background at you know, at Causal and Akunu before that, like, yeah, I was going to have opinions about the direction the product should go, and about how we should sell it and the company strategy, right? So he wanted a title that was more reflective of that. But honestly, like, you know, I think I hired two product managers whilst I was VP product. And yeah, I wasn't a very good VP product. Like, I was very much in a kind of tech vision strategy role and still do a lot of work with customers. I love going in the field and, you know, joining our sales team, meeting our customers and going to conferences and working with the community. Like, and I still have a very varied role in my job. But yeah, I wouldn't read too much into the VP product title. Like, that was not reflective of the role, I don't think.
Fair. And now it has been like over 6 years at Grafana Lab.
Longest job I've ever had.
A lot of things have changed from 25 people to over 1,000. Is there like a way to summarize this journey?
Yeah, I don't want to pitch Grafana Labs too much, but we talk about it. We have a simplified story we tell about the last, yeah, you know, Grafana Labs is 10 years old, right? The project's just over 10 years. The company's 10-ish years old. And, you know, before David and I joined, the main focus of the company was the Grafana project, right? And most people were working on that. We had a hosted graphite solution based on a project called Metric Tank, which we've kind of deprecated and sunset now. But yeah, mostly the focus was on Grafana and Grafana Enterprise. And then when David and I joined, that was when we kind of shifted gears to be focused more on Prometheus and the Prometheus ecosystem and Loki and Tempo and then eventually Pyroscope. You know, now things like adaptive metrics and adaptive logs. And we're, you know, really big on this, you know, databases for telemetry, for observability. And we think about that as Act Two. And you know, I could literally spend 5 hours talking about all the nuances of like how we've architected the databases and all the things we've learned. And, you know, we're constantly like, I'm really proud of, we call this LGTM, by the way. We have like funny, you know, whereas we think of Act One and Grafana as big tent, right? And multi-data source and prioritizing interoperability. We think of this Act Two as LGTM, right? Which is, yeah, sure, it's the thing you write on a code review, but it's also like, it also means it's the point at which we extended Grafana to do logs and traces and not just metrics, right? So we added data sources for that. But it's also Loki and Grafana and Tempo and Mimir, right? And we intentionally like lined up the first letters, mostly so we could remember which one did which. But yeah, like very proud of the architecture and the strategy there and the team that we built and the work that they did. And like, yeah, I do think we've got some of the best like databases for observability telemetry. And I'm also super proud that they're open source, right? We've been able to stay true to those open source roots. We've, you know, the vast majority of the work the databases team does, like, and when I say vast majority, I mean like 90% of the work that team does is completely in the open. And yet we've managed to build a successful business out of that. But I would say about 3 years ago, things changed. You know, our technology that we were selling, you know, and let's face it, we were a tech company selling tech, had started to appeal to a different audience, right? So previously, you know, you'd get me or one of the, you know, one of the early founding engineers up on stage evangelizing for the unique way we do shuffle sharding, or, you know, the new way we're changing the compactor to
blazing fast query caching.
Yeah, or the query caching, right? That was probably the last piece of code I actually wrote. Yeah, you know, you'd get us talking about tech, but the audience shifted. The audience shifted from, like, you know, the likes of ourselves and you know, technologists, innovators who really want to, like, use the latest thing and then figure out how to get value out of it themselves, like learn PromQL, build dashboards, like, you know, assemble a system. And then it started to be a way more mainstream audience who are like, oh, I heard Prometheus is the thing and everyone's being successful with it, so I should probably do it. And they, let's face it, they do not want to learn PromQL. Like, they don't want to build their own dashboards. They're expecting a solution to a problem instead of a set of technologies. And this was a hard lesson for us as a company, right? Because, like, I remember 3-4 years ago, a lot of the feedback from the community and our customers were, your software's too hard to use, right? And I'm like, well, we've been making it easier and easier every year, but we were only making it easier incrementally. And what we actually needed was a change of perspective, of mindset, where instead of selling tech, we were selling solutions, right? And so that's really... that was the big shift for us as a company 3 years ago, where we started going, no, actually, when you sign up to Grafana Cloud, you know, you don't want to be, you know, dumped into an empty Grafana, you know, and wiring up your own data sources and building your own dashboards. You want to be given instructions to install an agent. You want to, you know, be given some pre-canned dashboards for common systems. You know, you want things to just work out the box, right? And to be easy to use and to be opinionated and be solution oriented. And so that was the big shift for us at Grafana Labs. And that's what we call Act 3, right? These kind of easy opinionated solutions. It's also, you know, come back to that point about open source, like it serves as really good differentiation between our open source technology and platform and the commercial products in Grafana Cloud are these curated solutions. And since then, like, we've gone all in on this, right? So we've launched our own application observability solution. We've launched, you know, we have hundreds of curated packages of dashboards for everything you imagine. You know, we have an IRM solution, you know, a PagerDuty competitor. We have a load testing and synthetic monitoring solution. Like, you name it, like, Grafana Cloud is now a set of solutions built on top of this LGTM platform. And they're all designed to be opinionated and easy to use. And under the scene, they're all just issuing, like, PromQL queries and LogQL queries. But yeah, like, and it's still, you know, in a really nice way, it still retains the flexible, extensible kind of underpinnings. So, if you ever want to see, you know, if you ever want to take one of the pre-canned dashboards and enhance it, yeah, you can. Like, the dashboards are just JSON files in a Git repo, right? You know, or JSONIC files if you're a real masochist like me. You know, if you want to, like, you know, do something custom, you can. Like, you've still got all the power of the stack, but you just don't have to out of the box. Yeah, so that's Act 3 for Grafana Labs. That seems to be resonating with the team. And now, of course, like, that's actually the genesis of, by the way, the Prometheus agent stuff that Robert and I did, right? Like, was because we were telling people, oh, you want to buy our hosted Prometheus solution? First install Prometheus. And people are like, that's a bit weird. And so we built the cut down, you know, the slim down, what was originally the Grafana agent. And then we upstreamed that to Prometheus.
Do you think that you still needed, like, this first act, right? So that you have these hardcore users to kind of help you build the product and help you figure out what are the things that, you know, Grafana should be doing? Or do you think you could have started, like, way earlier with this?
No,
like,
you know, who knows, right? Like, there's no counterfactuals in real life. Like, I don't think Grafana Labs would exist as a company and as an organization the way it does if it didn't do Grafana first. And there's still huge value in Grafana. Like, to be clear, these acts aren't sequential. Like, we still have 150 engineers working on the Grafana project, and it still drives, like, 30-40% of our revenue, right? So it's still a wildly popular product for us. And if anything, it's only going from strength to strength. Like, the new stuff we did in Grafana 11 around these explore interfaces, these queryless interfaces for Prometheus and Loki and soon Tempo and Pyroscope, like, make it even more easier to use for a wider audience, right? And like, Grafana Alerting got rebuilt a few years ago based around the Prometheus alerting concepts and technology. You know, so we're still investing heavily in Grafana, and it still drives a lot of revenue. And it's still, when you go and talk to people and our users and our community and our customers, it's the thing we're known for, you know. And, you know, it's honestly still the best. I don't think this is debatable. I don't think this is too opinionated. Like, it is clearly the best dashboarding system out there. Like, And we're still committed to making it work very well for other data sources other than Prometheus, right? And, you know, it's there's this kind of healthy tension internally where, you know, the Grafana team prioritize, you know, data sources based on popularity, and the Prometheus and Loki ones do not get all the attention, right? As nor should they. But, you know, then obviously Act 2 is different, you know, and still something we're investing heavily in, another 150 plus engineers working on our databases. And Act 3 is different as well. And they can have, you know, this structure we've got, this kind of story we tell ourselves, like, helps us have different, sometimes competing priorities for different teams, and yet all kind of see how it fits into the big picture.
Yep.
Yeah, beautiful.
I will say, on that note, there's a really interesting kind of thought experiment on that. Do we really need this? Because there's a breed of observability startup coming out at the moment, and they are putting everything in ClickHouse, right? Putting everything in big columnar store, you know, standardizing on the OpenTelemetry schema and the OpenTelemetry collector, and then putting all of their R&D effort into building an experience on top of that. And that's my view, is the, like, skip Act 1 and 2 and just go straight to Act 3. And they are very impressive technology and startups, and they get very far very quickly, right? And, you know, they can have something that compete with our stack, you know, in a matter of, like, you know, less than a year. And yeah, you know, that worries me, but there's nothing I can do about that, right? We've already spent that money and that cost, and, you know, we've already done that investment. And it's not like just getting rid of all of them and moving to a columnar store would actually work for us. But I feel like the people that are building on ClickHouse for observability get very far very quickly. Like, they go 0 to 60. I'm a car guy, right? They go 0 to 60 very quickly, much faster than we did, right? You know, it took us 6-7 years to get to 60 mile an hour. It takes them a year, right? But the 60 to 100 mile an hour, like, I don't mind electric cars, but I'm not an electric car guy, right? I don't optimize for 0 to 60. I want a car that can go 60 to 100 just as quickly, right? I feel like you run out of steam if you don't, for instance, have that deep database expertise in your company, right? If you know, another thing about these columnar stores is their query costs, you know, scale linearly with the size of the data, right? And they're very fast and great to query, but you end up being dominated by these query costs at massive scale at 100 mile an hour. And I do feel like you end up, you know, putting caches, right? And those caches end up looking a lot like a time series database. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, you kind of end up backing yourself into a very similar set of technology and architectural decisions that we have anyway. And so, you know, do I wish we'd done things differently? I mean, there are millions of things I wish we'd done differently throughout every, you know, every day, every decision. Like, but no, I don't, I think we're in a good place. And I think it's like Stonebreaker or someone who says, like, all databases converge to be basically the same thing anyway, right? Like, with long enough time, you know, and I said earlier, right, all technology was invented by IBM 50 years ago anyway, so.
Wow. From the big perspective of from your story, like, two things I'm curious about. Like, sounds like you are definitely passionate about what you do. So there are kind of moments where you had to pivot because there is some trend going on, and that could give you more value, essentially, if you would pivot, right? To, like, from logging to Prometheus first, from virtualization to, like a storage system, whatever, or I think you switch to something else. But two questions first. Like, first of all, like, when you feel like it's time to pivot and you kind of, like, drop the initial idea, like, what is the signal that you're waiting for to switch? If there is anything they could kind of, like, formalize. And second thing, have you ever had this feeling of, like, you know, like, this, how you fight against this friction of yourself? Like, I don't want to drop this baby. I actually love it. I don't like it. I don't like this new trend. You clearly fight it off, or you don't have this problem. Can you share more insights on that?
Yeah, there's, you know, I think, like, tech startups are almost fetishized in our space, right? Like, and you've got to have the leanest possible startup, and you've got to pivot as quickly as possible. And, like, I'm not that person, right? Like, when you look at the history of my career, at least, I don't actually look at these as particularly large pivots, right? it's a series of very small decisions that add up over time. And yeah, you spend an hour telling a 15-year story. It looks like a series of very large pivots. But the reality is, at the time, none of them were. Right. At the time, you know, the switch from virtual machine storage to Cassandra was one guy in the company built a prototype to do that, and it slowly built steam. Right. It was never a big group of people sat down and made the decision to throw everything away and start from scratch. Right.
Yeah.
You look at the multi-act story I told about Grafana, and the reality was the lines between these acts are super blurry, right? And it is just a story, right? It's a gross simplification that makes it make sense. But the reality is, like, you know, I didn't mention Graphite and Metric Tank in the story. You know, the fact that the agent actually was started 4 or 5 years ago, not 3 years ago, right? You know, each one of these blurs into the other. So it's like, all I would say, and definitely one of the things I found, not recently, but the last couple of years has been particularly helpful, is like, if you admit your mistakes to people and then tell them what you're doing about it, what you've done about it, what you're going to change, what you've learned, I mean, it's much more endearing. It's much more honest. It's much more kind of human. And so that's the kind of, you know, all my stories are now built around the mistakes I made and what I learned from them, right? And once you start to realize, you know, I think, you know, a young version of Tom was criticized for never saying he was wrong. And now all I ever talk about is how I was wrong in many ways. But yeah, like, I think that's healthy in general. I think, like, you should very much, like, constantly be admitting your mistakes and talking about what you've learned from them and moving on. Don't fetishize it, right? Like, this isn't like, you're still trying to build a business, right? You're still trying to make money. Like, you know, if you don't want to make money, don't start a company, like, start a charity. And you're still trying to, you know, build whatever it is, right? And so there's definitely, like, sunk cost fallacy is a common term thrown around, right? And you do get attached to ideas. And you need, you know, like, honestly, I don't like this idea that you should, you know, throw everything away critically all the time, because, like, good example would be Tempo, right? The distributed tracing system we built at Grafana Labs that Joe Elliott built and team, right? But yeah, like, I remember a couple of years ago, we'd been working on Tempo for a long time and it wasn't particularly popular, to be brutally honest. And Joe came to me, he's like, Tom, you know, I think we should relicense Tempo. I think we should make it Apache. I think the AGPL license is holding it back. And I think we should donate it to the CNCF. And, you know, and I think we should, you know, move on generally from Tempo because it's not gaining the traction.
But isn't it because tracing is just not getting traction?
I mean, you know, sure, maybe. Who knows, right? Like, and I said to Joe, just give me one more year, right? Because sometimes you need that, like, bloody-minded perseverance. And, like, sometimes you need the sunk cost fallacy. And Tempo is our fastest growing product now. Like, Tempo is, like, we sell millions of dollars worth of it now. I mean, tens of millions. I don't know off the top of my head. And I think it's because things like OpenTelemetry has made the instrumentation side of tracing much easier, right? And things like Baylor and the eBPF work we've been doing has made the instrumentation much easier. So it's now trivially easy to actually get high quality traces out of applications with minimal modifications. And then we've built our APM, our AppOlly experience on top of Tempo. And so now it's also significantly easier to use and get value out of these traces, right? And you don't have to write TraceQL queries and just, like, visualize them and link to them with exemplars and so on. And so I think we had to persevere, right? We had to believe in, the opposite of the sunk cost fallacy, right? We had to, like, commit. And I do think, you know, Cortex was not very successful for multiple years, right? You know, and eventually we forked it to Mimir and so on. But, like, it took, you know, I've basically been working on that code now for 8 years, right? And if you know, any other, you know, founder type person who had, like, you know, read the Lean Startup book too much would have abandoned that a long time ago, right? And if you look in the, you know, in the history of scalable Promethei, there's many abandoned projects that showed promise, but that, you know, couldn't be sustained, or the founding engineers wanted to move on and do other things. And you kind of, you know, I know this is probably, like, you know, the wrong thing to say on a startup podcast, but kind of sometimes you just need to persevere and keep trying.
What made you persevere? Like, was it like your personality is just like that? Or you saw so much promise and you...
Every job I've had up until Grafana Labs, I was at for 2 years or less, right? So I definitely don't have that in me to like work on the same project for 8 years. This is the first time I've ever done that. I think there's a couple of reasons, right? One, I was at that point in my career, I was financially independent by this point. You know, I bought a house, you know, a car. I didn't need to like chase the next thing. Like I was relatively chill about my career at that point. The thing I was chasing was something that was interesting and exciting to do. And I wanted to be the one that did it, not like, you know, manage the team of people that did it, to be brutally honest. Like I didn't want to be in the room when it happened. I wanted to be the one, you know, dealing with the, you know, massive incidents where your entire cluster's gone and you've got customers screaming at you, because I wanted to experience that. And, you know, as I said, back when I was at Google, I was kind of envious of the engineers that got to work on the hard problems. I wanted to work on the hard problems. And to work on hard problems, you got to persevere, because, you know, when we turned up the first Cortex cluster, we had zero customers, right? And it wasn't until we had lots of customers and persevered that you got that new breed of really interesting problem of like, okay, how do I do, you know, I've got 1,000 replicas of this service. How do I actually, like, you know, deal with operational issues? How do I make it scale further? Right. You know, so the other thing is, like, I don't know, it seems obvious in hindsight, and it's very easy to say it was obvious Prometheus was going to be successful. But like, I did believe that Prometheus was going to be very successful. Right. And I did believe, you know, in the concepts, in the idea, in the technology. Yeah. And so like, there was a little bit of blind faith, like, that made me persevere with this. But also, like, I wanted to be the one. I just want, you know, purely selfishly wanted to be the person to experience it. I mean, obviously, I've moved on from that now. And now my job is slide decks and podcasts. But like, you know, and now, you know, now I am jealous of the engineers in Grafana Labs who get to work on these really interesting problems. But I also recognize my, you know, I've grown up as a person and my skill set now. I'm not the best software engineer at Grafana Labs by a very long measure. Like, I'm probably one of the worst. Although there's an interesting story there. I know I keep darting around in topics, but we'll edit this to make it sound coherent. Like, there's an interesting topic where I think the reason Loki was successful from an engineering perspective was because I did a bad job of implementation, right? Like, I rushed the first, you know, 0.1 version of Loki was a huge rush. Like, I wrote most of it on a plane and in a hotel room before KubeCon when we launched it. Like, literally, you can go and look in the Git repo, like, it's there as the history. And, I rushed it so quickly because I, you know, the ideas were sound, but the implementation was atrocious. You know, and I was not precious about it. It just had to work. And then hiring good engineers to improve Loki was easy. It was a good idea. It was like, it had good like mindshare and traction. And there was so much low hanging fruit to fix in the mess that I'd made. And I had so many engineers going, Tom, you're an idiot. Your code's terrible. Look, let me fix it for you. I'm like, oh no, don't fix that. It's brilliant. Like, you know, it's the easiest way to motivate engineers. You know, it's the adage of like, you know, the easiest way to get the answer on the internet isn't to post the question, but it's to post the wrong answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Think of the implementation of Loki was the wrong answer to that problem. And everyone flocked to provide the right answer and it flourished. Right. So, yeah, I don't know what the question was again, but like.
No, this is beautiful. Right? It's a motivation for people.
Motivation to do a bad job. Like,
Exactly. But if you do it like 90% correct, then it would be just boring, tedious bugs that reproduce and like nobody would like to work on it. Yeah.
And you become, if I thought my implementation of Loki was 90% correct, I would have been precious about it. And I would have been like, no, that's like that for a reason. Don't change that. Don't, you know, da, da, da. But instead, like I remember when Ed joined, Ed Welsh is now kind of the Loki spiritual leader. He hates it when I describe him as the spiritual leader. When Ed joined, I was not precious. I'm like, Ed, throw it all away, like burn it down and re-implement it. And he did, like, and the team did, and they did a fantastic job. And Owen and Cyril and the team, the early team around Loki did an amazing job of making Loki what it is today. Like, and I feel almost embarrassed to say that I wrote the first version or I started the Loki project, because none of my code exists anymore. Like, and I can't claim any credit for what Loki has become. Yeah.
Wow. This is a good.
So just going back to kind of startups, both of your startups, Akuno and Kozo, they were acquired, but now you're kind of on the other side. You already mentioned like Pyroscope, you mentioned like Low Testing and K6. Both of these are...
Amixer, Pace.
Yeah, yeah.
Asserts. Yeah, we've done 7 acquisitions now at Grafana Labs.
How are you thinking about these acquisitions? How do you find startups that are interesting for Grafana? How do you evaluate whether they will be a good fit? And how do you decide to pull the trigger?
Oh, wow. Yeah. So I wouldn't... Yes, people, again, fetishize acquisitions, right, as like the end goal of a startup and as success as a founder is getting your company bought. It is not in neither of my, the companies that I started that were sold was acquisition success, to be very clear. Like in both cases, it was talent, it was acquihire,
yep.
It was the idea that was valuable maybe, and or the team or whatever. And success came later, you know, after as part of a larger organization, those ideas really, you know, came to fruition. Definitely true about Grafana Labs. And honestly, like our M&A kind of philosophy, for want of a better term, at Grafana Labs is the same. Like we're not, I don't want to buy a company where they're going to view joining Grafana Labs as the mission and the goal and success, right? Like I love working with other founders. Like I love working with those people. And it's going to sound really pretentious, but that intersection of, you know, tech and business and tech, you know, that art of the possible, that's what excites me. Right, get an engineer who's capable of implementing a solution to a problem, like, and understanding the customer and interacting with the customer and understanding the problem from that level. That's brilliant. That's what I'm passionate about. And I think that's what we have in the companies that we bought at or that joined Grafana Labs. Right, I don't like to say we bought them. Right, like I much prefer to say like they joined Grafana Labs. You know, and that, you know, and in all of these cases, like the sum of the parts is always greater than the sum of the whole. I don't like doing large acquisitions, to be really clear. Like, you know, if you have grown your company to 50 people and want to sell it to Grafana Labs, it's probably not going to be me the one, arguing for that. Because like, by that point, you've developed your own culture, you've developed your own patterns and processes and way of working. And that's actually the hardest thing, integrating the company in. Like the tech integration's easy. With every single one of these acquisitions, the tech integration's gone very quickly. The challenge is the people and the culture, right? And you can't have it so that like the acquisition, the company joining Grafana Labs, you know, still retains its identity, to be brutally honest, right? They can, you know, we honor them by like naming the product or the service after the company, right? And you know, that's definitely the case with like Asserts and K6 and others, but like you're part of a bigger organization. And I love the culture at Grafana Labs, right? We really put a lot of time and effort into defining what it means to be, we call them Grafanistas. It's very cringeworthy to the outside world, but like internally, you know, you get used to it. But yeah, we call them Grafanistas, and like we prioritize autonomy and transparency and like, being remote first as a company, well, remote only really now as a company, like and all of the, you know, being very asynchronous in our communication patterns, being very written. There's a lot of stuff we prioritize, and not every organization, group of people share those priorities, right? And so that's really what we're looking for is like, are you, you know, we've generally like, there's a few, for me at least, a few pretty non-negotiables. Like if you are not a remote first company, you are not going to be able to work at Grafana Labs, right? You're not going to be able to join in and, you know, you're not, you know, imagine like going from working in an office face-to-face communication one day to your office doesn't exist and your team is now spread around the world. It's never going to work, right? Like open source obviously is a huge part of the culture at Grafana Labs. Like it's beyond just the business and culture. It's like, it's key to how we think about what we do. And so again, if you're not an open source company, I mean, this isn't like a hard and fast rule, but if what you're working on isn't open source or at least doesn't build on open source and use open source, you're going to struggle to think the way we think. Loads of other, like, obviously like I much prefer it if you're writing in Go and if you're using Prometheus and running on Kubernetes and already containerized, because I don't want to go through that process. But none of these are like hard and fast rules, but these are like the kind of things we think about. And then, you know, one of the biggest challenges, if I'm brutally honest, and, you know, some of my best friends are VCs type thing, but like we've just come out of a period where startups have been massively overvalued, right? And raised ridiculous sums of money, which in my opinion makes them unacquirable. Right, because the value isn't there to match the valuation they had 2 years ago, right? And you're never going to do a down round, right? So yeah, like a lot of, you know, if you're a company with, you know, a huge previous valuation and have raised a huge amount of money, you know, and your cap table's a mess and you don't really have significant revenue to speak of, like, yeah, like I don't know what your future holds, I'm afraid. I'm sorry about that, but like, I'm probably not going to be able to like join Grafana. Maybe, but maybe not, right? You know.
Fair. I think this makes a lot of sense. Well, Tom, I know we are a little bit over time, but it was super interesting.
Finish on that positive note.
Yeah. It was a super interesting conversation. I personally learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot as well. I have one final question for
Please.
You. Where can people follow you and where can people find more about Grafana Labs and what you guys are doing?
I mean, I'm on Twitter. I'm Tom_Wilkie on Twitter. I'm not as active as I used to be, but like I still, you know, I still post pictures of my latte art on there and the pizzas I make. Like I'm on, where else am I? I'm on LinkedIn, obviously. Like, you know, if you want to see my CV or something, that's where it is. But no, like, you know, just like we do a lot of community events at Grafana Labs. So I go to like probably 5 or 6 conferences a year. So all the usual ones, like I'm trying to get to SREcon in Dublin. You know, I'll be at KubeCon, trying to get to the KubeCon in India as well. That'd be exciting. You know, and so come find me at one of the Grafana Labs booths at one of our events or the meetups in London or, you know, anything like that. And if you want to find out more about Grafana Labs, like our conferences are probably the best place. Like, so we're running Observability Con in New York in November. I think tickets have just gone on sale for that. I'll be there. I'll be doing the keynote. And yeah, like, and then hanging around talking to people. But yeah, like, or come to, we have webinars. We have literally, go to the events calendar on our website and there is something happening almost every day. Like, we're at that scale now, which is so exciting. So yeah, like, come and have a chat.
Awesome. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much, Ivan. Good to
thank
see you
again,
so
Bartek. Much. Yeah, thank you.